Things we need to think about is that we speak about teenagers, and that's got a very clear kind of temporal definition, but teenagers were invented as a term in the 1950s, I think, and if you think about what being in that age, for most people still in the world today, it's not being relatively, you got lots of pressures on you in terms of survival, in terms of working, in terms of perhaps having a family, that our adolescents don't have that pressure on them at least. So the adolescence is I wonder how much it is a social construct. So there's physiological things going on. But if you think about it in evolutionary terms, then I guess that for most of our existence on the planet, then the people will be having children in their mid-teens. So whilst they're going through this turmoil, they've also now got to start thinking about the next generation. So Sarah Jane, how much is it how real is it scientifically, and how much have we created it by the particular way that we organise our society at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, adolescence is a social term. It's a social construct. The end of adolescence, actually, we normally define as the age at which you attain a stable, independent role in society. So we can go on a long time. There might
it's
be one or two. Yeah, 50, let's say. As you said, there are huge current, not just historical, but current cultural differences between societal expectations for this age group. In our society, it's completely acceptable to live at home and be in full-time education right into throughout the teens and into the 20s. In other cultures, that's absolutely not the case, and young people are expected to go out and earn their own money, become independent, have babies as soon as they reach sexual maturity. Some people have argued that this suggests that this adolescent period is just a social construct invented, about 100 years ago in the US. But I think that's not the case. I think there's really good evidence that actually adolescence represents a distinct, unique period of biological and psychological development. And that evidence comes from a phenomenon that we've already discussed, showing that, firstly, adolescent typical behaviours like risk-taking and socialisation increase in adolescence, not just in humans, but in other species too. Also, cross-culturally, even between cultures that differ vastly in their societal expectations of this age group, you can nevertheless see similarities between adolescent typical behaviours like risk-taking, sensation-seeking, and peer influence across cultures, and also across history. Even as far back as, I've got a quote here from Socrates. The children now love luxury. They have bad manners, contempt for authority. They show disrespect for elders and love chatter in the place of exercise. He was talking about adolescence.
Rory, do you think sometimes when you look back, especially when you see teenage children, you do slightly erase your own teenage experience? Think, know that I was but I was never like that. We have a little trick we play.
Yeah, I think Doug Larson said that few things are more satisfying than seeing your own children have teenagers of their own. and Robin Winds had the same sort of thing about when he became a parent and watching how his children dealt with their children. I think it is. It's a way that we tend to sort of erase bits of our own childhood. And it's only sometimes I think when you watch our own children and then think, oh, actually, yes, I remember what that felt like.
But I think when trying to approach is whether we know anything about the evolutionary reason for this change in our brains.
I think what you've got underlying here, Sarah Jane's outlined, is a developmental process. You've got a childhood or an infancy in which you need to do certain things, be quiet or just grow or whatever the particular niche that you're in makes you want to do. But then you've got to become an adult, and that involves some fairly rapid developmental and hormonal changes, and that's what causes the upheaval. In our case, it's about acquiring life skills, isn't it? It's about becoming yourself.
You would ask, what's the point of this period of life? What's the point of adolescence? And one of the points is to become independent from your parents and from your families. And in order to do that, you need to be a bit risk-taking, you need to experiment, explore your environment, and you need to affiliate with your peer group. You need to establish yourself in the social hierarchy. So from an evolutionary point of view, that those kinds of adaptive needs might explain things like increased peer influence and increased risk-taking during adolescence, which we see across species.
Rory?
No, I was going to say, it's interesting. So in a way, it's not the teenagers that are the problem. They're doing what they are programmed to do. They are developing socially, hormonally, all of those things at once. It's actually the parents that are the real problem. In fact, Steve Peters, who wrote The Chimp Paradox, got a lovely view of this. He said, it's actually not the teenagers, it's the parents and their rhetorical questions, where they say, are you stupid? To which the answer is, yes. Yes, we're stupid because we're finding out what stupid is. We're finding out what is stupid and what is sensible. The other question, don't you think? Well, no, because they're at a stage where they're in their lives where they're finding out all those processes. So leave them alone in their bedroom and don't worry about what they're doing.
I wanted to ask, Matthew talked about the different stages of our lives. And I wonder, when you're putting together an impression of someone, whether you consider this person, do you see them as kind of a four-dimensional object?
I think Donald Trump has a very teenage brain, let me tell you. I look at that, I have a brain, I call it Semtex. Because it's plastic and it's explosive. So, I think that deserved a better laugh, but anyway.
Well, I have never seen that work before. I think that deserved a better laugh. And they just went, yes, you're right. No, but
they're going to make a film, and I am going to be played by one of the great Hollywood actors, Macaulay Culkin. He's a little old now, but I think he's got the character.
Sorry, comparing Donald Trump to teenagers is just insulting to teenagers.
That's true. I wanted to ask Sarah, in your book you actually have, because we've talked about a lot of these ideas of the behaviour of teenagers, but you actually testing them in a scientific area. For instance, as you said, that the mixture of both peer pressure and risk taking, that you have worked on various different ways of trying to work out how much it is innate risk taking, how much it is peer pressure risk taking. Can you run us through, you know, at least one of the experiments that you used?
Yeah, so well, if you think about the kinds of risks that we worry about teenagers taking, so things like smoking or experimenting with drugs or dangerous driving, binge drinking, these are risks that they don't tend to do when they're on their own. In fact, we don't tend to do when we're on our own generally, but teenagers particularly, it's when they're with their friends that they might experiment with these risks. And it's been shown many, many times by lots of different experiments and in real world data, which I'll come back to in a second, that's true, that if you take a teenager on their own and you get them to do a risk-taking task when they have no distractions and they can concentrate on the task at hand, they don't tend to take more risks, actually, more often than not, than adults do. But if they have their friends with them, that's when they have this tendency to take risks. There was one nice experiment by a colleague in the US called Larry Steinberg. He got teenagers and adults into his lab. They took part in a driving game, like a video arcade driving video game. And they either did this when they were on their own, or they had a couple of friends standing behind them. And in the condition in which they had a couple of friends standing behind them, teenagers took about three times the number of risks that they took when they were on their own, whereas having a couple of friends standing behind them had no effect on the number of risks adults took. So it really seems to be critical in whether teenagers take risks is whether they have their friends with them. And it makes sense in terms of peer pressure, because if the evolutionary pressure is to be accepted by your peer group and not to be ostracized by your peer group, then you need to be really aware of what your peer group want you to do. And so you're much more likely to go along with your mates and do things like experiment with things that they're experimenting with. So, for example, one example I often give is a very intelligent, say, 13-year-old girl who knows all about the risks of smoking. Nevertheless, when she's out with her friends at the weekend and they're all smoking and they offer her a cigarette, for her, what's the more risky decision? Saying yes to a cigarette, even though she knows the potential health risks of that, or saying no and risking ostracizing herself from her peer group? But we would argue that for a teenager, that's the bigger risk.
Rory, how do you, having heard this discussion, and obviously I know it's something that interests you, anyway, how do you think this changes the way that parents, you know, should interact with their teenagers? Because, I mean, in one way, you could just go, oh, don't worry, darling, I know why you're behaving like this. I've seen the MRI. But I don't think I have an inkling that won't wash with them. So,
but you know what? I mean, so many parents used to think, well, you know, you have children, but where's the instruction booklet? You know, I think this is the instruction booklet, because even, you know, just doing the preparation for this programme, it made me look at my daughters in a totally different way. One is 14 and one is 16. And, you know, people say, as Sarah Jane said at the very beginning, people say, oh, it's hormones and, you know, it's difficult teenagers. But now when you understand what is going on in the brain, as we said very early on, the emotional changes, the physical changes, the hormonal changes we mentioned as well, but the speed at which the brain is developing and adapting to all these things, you know, I almost want to go back and apologise and say, no, you know, it's I understand, but of course we don't understand. That's the point.
Well, in the light of this research, could you see a time when we understand this developmental process better, that we change the way that we run society, we change the way that we educate children and teenagers in the light of our enhanced understanding?
I think so. The way I see it is that we place a lot of expectations on teenagers. And I think that might be because they, you know, when they've gone through puberty, they look like adults. So we almost expect them to be like adults, to make adult decisions, to be able to plan like adults. But in fact, their brain is not adult at all. The brain still has a long way to go in terms of development. Unlike younger children who very much look like little children, we don't expect them to plan their day or plan their week. We do that for them. We make their decisions for them. We stop them taking risks. We, in contrast, allow teenagers, we give them a lot of autonomy and we allow them freedom to make their own decisions. Perhaps we need to adjust the way we place these high pressures and high expectations on teenagers in society and in schools, for example. Also, I think I would have found all this information about the teenage brain really useful when I was a teenager to try, because, you know, it's not that difficult to remember what it's like to be a teenager. It's a pretty hard time for a lot of teenagers. There's a lot of turmoil and a lot of change. And to know that this is a natural part of brain development, I think would have been pretty useful, at least for me. And so, you know, including it in the school curriculum might not be a bad thing.
I think the other thing, on a rather more serious note, is that exactly as you've been saying, that this is a crucial period where mental illness can develop. And I think both for children, teachers and for parents, just to be aware of that, and without, you know, developing a hypochondria about any slight change in behaviour, that you really need to listen and think about what could be happening and to seek help if you've got the slightest doubts, because this is a tremendously fragile and dangerous moment for children, has been all through the ages. And as I said earlier on, there may be more pressures now because of social media, and so you can actually now get peer pressure from bazillions of people all around the planet, not just your mates in the schoolyard. So I think that for me is the really serious lesson that parents need to think very hard, and teachers as well.
Well, it also strikes me that if you're asking people to have gone through their GCSEs and A-levels and actually their degrees, and pretty much for most people completed their formal education before their brain has fully formed into an adult brain, it doesn't seem to be the most sensible way of running a society.
There's a whole lot of teenagers now who are considering a class action.
Maybe always enjoy that moment where Brian Cox says, I don't know. Doesn't happen that often. It's always a fun bit.
Well, I don't know.
We had a question for the audience. It's not a rock question from the audience. We don't allow that kind of thing. We gave the audience a question. We asked them, what did you do as a teenager that you wish you hadn't? And looking at the fact we've got fewer answers that have been handed to us than normal, I imagine many of you were tremendously honest, and our producer went, well, we can't give that to them. So I'm still a teenager, and I think everything I've done is right.
Turn the fire hose on at school to see how long it would take for water to come through the coils.
Try to drunk email Brian Cox at 3 a.m. asking for work experience. P.S. You never got back to me, Harry Willis.
The question, what did you do as a teenager that you wish you hadn't? This is looking like John Lennon, in brackets, for the record, I'm a woman.
Paid full price for a D-Ream ticket. So next week we're going to broaden out the peculiar behaviour of teenage humans to doing the peculiar behaviour of all animals, with a panel that includes a head of zoology and the founder of the Sloth Appreciation Society. So they're bound to be late. We still have a question, which I read about this from a sloth expert once, which is, can sloths really survive a nuclear war? So we'll find that out next week if the Ethics Committee give us permission.
I don't see a problem with it, actually. Well, cruise missiles are really accurate, aren't they? So you put it on a Pacific atoll, take it out.
It could happen any moment now. Don't joke about it. Little rocket man, Cox. He's going to launch that missile.
This is a simple experiment, Dom.
I like the simple ones.
Thank you very much to our panel, Matthew Cobb, Sarah Jane Blakemore, Rory Bremner. Thank you very much for listening. Bye-bye.
Do you want that nice again?
Hello, I'm Robin Ince.
And I'm Brian Cox.
And having had a guest raven outstare Brian in a battle of wits earlier this series, today we're returning to fauna and looking at the behaviour of animals. In fact, we were going to have a guest leopard on, but unfortunately actually broke away from its leash and picked up Nicholas Parsons and has just been dragging him all the way down Great Portland Street with Paul Merton running behind going, deviation, deviation.
Today, we are looking at the science of animal behaviour. How do we know how eels mate, to where swallows migrate, and how bats navigate?
Joining us to discuss eels, bats, and frogs' underpants, we have a distinguished panel of misbehaving fauna, and they are...
My name's Rory Wilson. I'm a professor in zoology at Swansea University, and I've been told to say what my favourite animal is, and it's a penguin, because they're birds, and they think they're fish. They're convinced they're fish.
My name's Lucy Cook, and I'm a zoologist and author of The Unexpected Truth About Animals. The animal that I'd like to champion is the naked mole rat, which may be unfeasibly ugly, but its extraordinary lifestyle may hold the cure for cancer.
And my name's Rufus Hound. I'm unfeasibly ugly, but my extraordinary lifestyle may hold the cure for cancer.
This is our panel! Lucy, we're going to start off first of all with a fact about you. You are the founder of the Sloth or Sloth Appreciation Society. Which one do you go with, sloth or sloth?
I go with sloth because there's a moth that lives on the sloth and it's a sloth moth and not a sloth moth.
So, is it really a moth that lives on the sloth?
It lays its eggs in the sloth's dung and lives its adult life in the sloth's fur. It's a distinctly unenviable life cycle, it has to be said, but, you know...
So what is it about the sloth, though, that you find particularly appealing?
Well, they're hugely misunderstood. That's what I think, is that they've been derided throughout history for being lazy and stupid. And the first explorers that went to South America and saw sloths, there was a conquistador, Spanish conquistador, the first person to describe a sloth, and he said it was the stupidest animal that could be found on the planet. You know, which is pretty damning. And then it gets named after a deadly sin. But the reason why the early explorers so misunderstood the sloth in the first place was because they were looking at it the wrong way up. Because here was an animal that spends its life hanging from the trees. It lives an incredibly energy-efficient, inverted existence, which requires half the muscle mass of a normal mammal because they don't have to hold themselves upright. So it's very energy-efficient. But if you turn them the wrong way up, gravity removes their dignity, and they sort of lie like a, you know, sprawling on the ground and are forced to sort of drag themselves along by these hooks as if they're mountaineering on a flat surface, which so the early explorers who went to explore the New World obviously were brought specimens, and they didn't see the sloth in the context of its natural environment. And of course that's the key, the very key, Roy will back me up here, to understanding animal behaviour, is you have to see it in the context. If you take an animal out of context and try and understand it, you're going to have a very difficult job.
Now, I know, Rory, you were involved sort of in an academic sense in monitoring, observing sloths. It doesn't sound like too difficult a thing to do from the description. It's not the fastest moving of animals. But what are the challenges?
You know, you need a massive amount of patience if you're just going to look at them. But that's the trick about sloths, is in the wild, they will outpatient you. In other words, they hang there, and they're rather hard to see, and they do nothing, and they do nothing, and they do nothing. And then you look again, and they've gone. So, in fact, the way we solved the problem was by putting really sophisticated tags on them. And so you put the tag on them, the tag records everything they do, and then you look at them, and then they've gone, and you think, you know, it's still being, your lifestyle's still being written down. You just have to get the tags back.
Can you describe these tags that you use? Because, you know, just picturing a sloth, you would think that the what you need to do is sit there and observe it in field work. What does the tag do? What kind of data does it produce? And how does that help in understanding their behaviour?
It's a generic tag. In other words, it's a thing that does lots of stuff. And actually, we don't just put it on sloths. We put them on cheetahs and on sharks and on penguins and condors and all sorts of different animals. And it's the same tag.
And then you press a button and they all converge and the last one standing's the winner.
Last one sitting. And so they've got tons of sensors in them. So they've got accelerometers, which sounds an anathema if you're a sloth. But anyway, magnetometers and pressure sensors, temperature, relative humidity. And even on a sloth, we record something like 400 pieces of data every second, continuously. So they wear these things, and it's like having a miniature computer. And from this, you can pick up every footstep, every left turn, every right turn, every minute detail about their behavior. And so whether you're dealing with a sloth or whether you're dealing with a badger, there's no time in its secret life, even if it's trying to bore you like a sloth, that you won't have some pivotal information on it. So that's what we do with the tags.
Rufus, we want to go to your kind of specialist area. You recently played a toad in a musical. How did you prepare for that animal behaviour-wise?
Well, I can't help but thinking you're taking the mick somewhat. But the God's honest truth is that it's quite standard practice at drama school that you do a term where you take an animal and you study it. And over 12 weeks, you look at how it moves and, you know, you begin to get some understanding of its behaviour. We got an afternoon. And we had this very brilliant woman, and I'm sure she is incredibly brilliant at what she does, worked for a very excellent drama school, and she was tasked with, for an afternoon, getting us to think about our animals and our animal movement. And toads, everything I found out about them the night before, which was as much notice as we had, basically burrow backwards into a hole and stay there. And then flollop out and get something to eat and then burrow backwards back into a hole. And so for 4 hours one afternoon, I just sat incredibly still in the corner of the room and then flolloped out, stuck my tongue out a bit, and then burrowed backwards back into it. And I thought this was, you know, an excellent character study. And then she came over to me and went, and I will always remember the disappointment in her eyes as she said to me, "I don't think you love toads."
What you're saying is Kenneth Graham may well have not done as much research as we might have imagined in the first place as to the behaviour of badgers, moles and toads.
To be honest, the whole point of Toad is that he doesn't want to be he's rebelling against what went before. So it was quite a useful afternoon as a kind of character study, because I realised, of course, if your life was sedentary in this way, why wouldn't you want to go fast instead and get the motor car poop?
Is there such a thing as a dull animal? Is there such a thing as an animal that only does that? Or is it always the case that animals' behaviour is more complex than we might suspect?
Yeah, well, the thing about animals is, if you're a human, you just don't appreciate the differences between them. So in other words, burrowing backwards into a, you know, your toad, you go backwards into a hole. It's not the burrowing backwards, it's the way you burrow backwards and stuff like that. So, we're all our eyes are just, fixated on particular human things, and we somehow have to get our heads into penguinies or lugwormies or whatever it is to be able to understand them properly. And actually technology does that for you.
Is there something, I mean, what are the animals that you have by observation, just gone, I didn't think I would ever have anything more than, say, an academic interest in this, and then you go, this becomes, even through sometimes its stillness, whatever it might be, that it becomes enthralling through the act of observation.
Well, I would say that the biggest surprise for me, because people often say, what's the most remarkable thing that's ever come out of putting tags on animals? Because you put tags on animals because you can't see them all the time, or even when you can see them, you can't measure what you want to measure. And the most extraordinary thing for me that we've ever discovered using tags was on wandering albatrosses. And wandering albatross, a big bird, 3.5 meter wingspan, you know, like a goose, it's sort of this big. And there was a problem with wandering albatrosses. We knew that they were feeding chicks, flying away for 6 days, and picking up squid. They come back and they give their chicks squid. And they're a bit, you know, they're not flashy birds. They're not fast birds. They're great flyers and all that. But we couldn't understand how they were catching squid. And more to the point, they were catching really big squid, And the first people said, well, they must be catching moribunds with their squid. They're dead. They pick them up, and that's why they fly all over the place, and dead squid aren't that common, but they can look for, you know, hours and hours, and then they'll pick them up. And they said, well, how's that going to happen? Because the squid they eat, when they die, they don't even float. So we had some students with some tags which were on wandering albatrosses, and she was looking at the data that came back, and she said, Rory, I think that, have a look at this computer. I think this tag's gone wrong. And what it translated into was the bird was spinning around. And we looked at more of the albatrosses, and it transpires that what happens in the darkness of the night in some areas of the ocean, that wandering albatrosses, when there's no moon, spin round in circles, paddling with their feet hard, and then periodically in the middle of this spinning round, they'll put their head down and they'll grab something and they'll swallow it. And what we think is happening, and we're actually putting tags on to verify this, is that they are, when the sea bioluminesces, you get these small animals in the sea that give out light when they get agitated. And in particular areas of the world, you can have incredible densities of these animals. And so the light, if you chuck a stone in the water, it can be so bright that you can read a book by it. It's absolutely unbelievable. So what we think they're doing is they fly to particular areas and they spin round in circles and create a ball of light. And the squid, much deeper down, say, oh, I must to the light. It is beautiful. and then they come up and the albatross says, you know, not only dinner, but, you know, candlelit dinner. And so they eat them. And that's how they do it. So that's one of these really crazy things that come out of putting tags on albatrosses or on an animal. And you could never in a million years would you observe that. Because try following an albatross.
Lucy, we're able now to observe so many different animal behaviours. But, I mean, in your book, where I think you spent, about a year and a half in a library going through the history of our understanding of animal behaviour, what for you were the most preposterous moments where you go, why did we believe that when now we have the better answer?
Well, I think the thing is I think you've got to be quite forgiving to scientists. Animals are very complicated to try and figure out. You know, some of the genuine behaviour or what's going on with an animal is even more ridiculous than what people thought. But certainly there are many examples of quite ridiculous things that we thought. So, for instance, take migration. So Aristotle, who was actually a brilliant scientist, who was the first true scientist, using proper scientific method, he was the first person to sit on his, you know, he's like, birds, you know, they're sort of here some of the time, aren't they? And then they're not here, are they? Where do they go then? And you know, brilliant, he actually sort of took on this problem and he came up with three solutions to the problem. The first one was that they migrate. They go to warmer climes, which was a brilliant idea and he should have just stopped there. but because the idea that, you know, small birds would travel thousands of miles to more favourable climes, it seemed so preposterous, he came up with another idea. His second idea was transmutation. And that was that birds, so for instance, redstarts and robins look a bit alike. They're about the same size. And most suspiciously, just like Clark Kent and Superman, you never see them together at the same time. They transmute from one to the other, from one season to the next, which obviously sounds preposterous to us now. But, you know, caterpillars turning into butterflies, that's preposterous as well. You know, so why not, you know? And his third theory actually was that they hibernated, which birds, there's only one true hibernating birds. Birds don't hibernate. But the hibernation thing stuck for like thousands of years. And in actual fact, the nascent Royal Society took on the idea, hotly debated the idea of hibernation. Not just hibernation, but whether swallows in particular hibernated underwater like fish. And there was one man who wrote this sort of fantastic paper, and in some ways, Brian, he reminds me a little bit of you in some ways. His name was Charles Morton, and he wrote this sort of best-selling book on physics that was used at Harvard University. And he wrote this, he said, it's just ridiculously, makes no sense whatsoever that birds would hibernate underwater. How could they? They couldn't breathe. No, they migrate to the moon.
Ha 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 ha. Is that in Wonders of the Solar System?
It's still possible. We've not done the experiment yet.
Good, let's move on. We should edit that because it might damage his TV career, that last sentence. See, but I wonder, Rufus, what about... I mean, I was suddenly thinking, we're talking about that when people are immersed with other animals, like Diane Fossey, of course, with gorillas, and Jane Goodall's incredible studies of chimpanzees, which totally changed our time. Would you... Is there a particular animal that you just think that would... To share time with, to get a true understanding?
Yeah, tapirs. I absolutely love tapirs to the point that I am currently so over people that I've been talking to my wife. For all practical reasons, we've worked out we can't really do it, but I want to live in the woods where there aren't people. And when we went down that path, we began to look whether or not there was the opportunity to acquire a lake, because male tapirs in the wild, they mate, but then they like their own space and like to go off. So we looked at whether or not we could run some sort of tapir sanctuary. They are magnificent. They're basically like furry pigs with half elephant noses, but they are also, for the ones that have been naturalized and around people, they begin to become almost quite pet-like at the same time. And they love being tickled and scratched. How they eat, there are Malaysian tapirs, and the babies are born, they look like zebras, and then that changes over time. And they are magical. They do a little bit look like sort of creatures from fantasy novels. And yes, I swear to you, if you said to me now, you don't ever have to show off again, but you can go and move to the middle of the woods and look after some tapirs, I would do that instead of this.
Oh, I get worried now, just that idea of seeing you running in a field. Who's that? Rufus Hound used to be on the telly. It's a bit scary.
What's that he's riding on the back of? Long story.
How do you choose which animal you're going to study? Because I know that you initially... you developed the tagging technology on penguins, didn't you? So you say a little bit about that, but also why did you choose to go and try and observe
penguins?
Yeah,
I was always besotted with penguins, to be honest. Well, from the age of four, when I was at the zoo with my mother and I saw them, I just thought the coolest things, because they were on the surface of the water and they just disappeared. I mean, that's the most amazing trick. And so this obsession was carried through to my PhD, which I did in South Africa. I went out there because the African penguin population had been plummeting. And it still is, incidentally, even though we know why. And I went out there and I said, well, it's clearly something to do with what they do at sea. And I went and I lived on an island with these penguins for a year. And it's quite depressing to begin with, because there I was on the island and all the penguins were there, 7,000 or something, a lot. And they'd all jump in the water in the morning and disappear and then come back in the evening. And so I say, where have they been? What have they done? You know. In those heady days, halcyon days, you couldn't just go to the penguin technology shop and say, I want a penguin tag, an African penguin tag, you know. And so I started making my own devices. I thought, first of all, I did many thousands of kilometers on boats and, reverse eating, because I'm not very good on boats. A lot of seasickness and penguins don't like being followed. They don't like boats. They don't like people. I did scuba diving. You can't see them there. So it's quite miserable. So I just thought, I'll make technology and I'll put it on the penguins. And so the tiniest bit of information, we knew nothing. To give you an idea, I had a friend called Ron Wooler who came out from Australia. And he was working on little blue penguins. And he said, we were trying to track penguins. I said, how did you do that? He said, we got a balloon and tied it with string to its feet. and honestly, this is true. And then we tried to follow them in boats. And I said, how long was the piece of string? He said, well, we measured out 5 feet. And I said, don't you think that was a bit, you know, ungenerous? And he said, well, we thought it seemed a lot at the time. They're only little penguins, you know. And I said to him, I have been recording depths of 130 meters for the African penguins. So, it doesn't seem like a good idea. So the point about it was, is that we knew absolutely nothing. And then bit by bit, you know, we got swimming speeds, we got diving depths, and the devices became more and more sophisticated. Nowadays, we're at a stage where, because it's just carried on, the technology's gone on, and now we can see every single fish they eat, the size of the fish, where they are, every flipper beat. So the inception of the problem for me was because there was absolutely no way of figuring out what penguins were doing at sea, and it was an urgent conservation question.
What's the most difficult animal that you've tagged?
They're all challenging. But some of the most, because the technology that we put on is nearly always, it records, and you've got to get the recorder back. So penguins are dead easy. They're on a nest. You pick them up, put it on the penguin, put it on the nest. Penguin goes away, then comes back to the nest. Things like sharks, pick up the shark, whale shark, 18 meters long, size of a bus, pick up the shark, we have to wait for it to swim past you. Nothing will make you hyperventilate into your snorkel more than a whale shark swimming towards you. And so you put you tag on its dorsal fin, and then you may never see that shark again. And so you have to say, I wish to recover this tag in a time when I believe I will recover it most appropriately. So in other words, it's going to pop off in 2 days. And you better hope in those 2 days, if you're working in Ningaloo Reef or somewhere, that's my Australian accent, if you're working in Ningaloo Reef, that it's going to be staying in the Ningaloo Reef area, because the tag will pop up and then transmit that it's there with VHF and you've got to pick it up with a boat. But if it decides to go off to Malaysia, then you'll never get your tag back. So anything in the ocean that's pelagic, that swims and moves fast, is really challenging.
Lucy, for you, the great mysteries that remain to be discovered.
Ooh.
Actually, before we go back, sorry, in our intro, we mentioned frogs and underpants, and I therefore feel that before we allow you the great mysteries, and there is a possibility that frogs and underpants may be the great mysteries, because I have no idea where this idea comes from. Lucy, frogs and underpants, ?
Yeah, well, trying to solve some of the great mysteries. A lot of the really big mysteries have been resolved now. And one of those was the mystery of fertilization. So a lot of animals, they just thought, just burst into life spontaneously. Then once they got microscopes and properly started slicing animals up and looking inside, they realized that there were these things called eggs, and it looked like the males produced something as well. But there was a big sort of debate over whether it was eggs or whether it was sperm that developed into the adult. Nobody really thought that it was the two things coming together. And the man that proved that it wasn't either or, but it was a bit of both, was a fantastically creative mind called Lazzaro Spallanzani, who sounds like a James Bond bad guy. He was obsessed with frog sex, and he'd watch frogs and like, going, what is going on? And he sliced open females and without them being gripped, because for those that don't know frog sex, the male hangs on very hard to the female in a sort of piggyback type style. But the male's sperm is sort of invisible in the water, so it was not really clear what the male was doing, but he sort of thought the male must be doing something, because when he sliced females open and tried to incubate the eggs, they turned into a mushy mess. But when the male did his funny piggyback ride, the eggs turned into tadpoles. So the logical thing to do was to craft bespoke underpants for the male frogs as a sort of all-body prophylactic that would catch whatever it was that the males were emitting. Fantastically, he tried various different materials. They tried pig's bladder, I think, and it turned out it was very nice and snug. It was good, stretchy, fitted well, like a sort of a Spanx-type arrangement. Nothing getting out, but unfortunately, it got all sort of mushy in the water. And then he settled on waxed taffeta, which was much better because it didn't get destroyed by the water, but the frogs would jump out of the underpants, which was very frustrating. So in the end, he put braces on them.
I just wonder if you, in terms of, as you discovered more about, the behaviour of animals and indeed the minds of animals, something we were talking about in the office before, which is when it actually changes your attitude towards, for instance, I know a lot of people, including Brian, who will no longer eat calamari because what he's found out about squid is so, like, no, I can't eat calamari anymore because of the level of intelligence.
Yeah.
Have you found anything that has changed your opinion enough to stop killing it? That wasn't how I was going to phrase that originally.
No, I'm still the lovable old animal psychopath I always was.
I asked that very good. No, I apologise.
It's true, actually. We filmed with an octopus, diving with it in Florida, actually, for one of the TV shows. And it sort of mimicked everything that I did. And it was a very intriguing animal. And I spoke to some of the researchers afterwards, and they said that they can be So when you have them in a lab, when you're, they know who comes into the lab, and some people they don't like and some people they do like. It's a very complicated, almost alien intelligence. And I found it such a powerful experience that I thought I just can't eat you on a plate anymore. So to this day, I have not eaten an octopus since that.
You say you met an octopus. I remember, again, on a school trip, we went to an aquarium and they were part of a chain that was going to rehouse this turtle. And so they had this big turtle in quite a small tank, but it was only there for a short period before it went on to the next place. So you could look in this tank and this turtle right at the bottom caught my eye. I looked at it and we eyeballed. There was this absolute connection. And I'm looking at the bottom of the tank and I started to stand up and the turtle floated at the exact same rate. So we never lost eye contact and it came right up to the top. And I thought, I'm going to be able to touch the top of this turtle. This is unbelievable. And it breached the water. So now we are literally face to face. And it sneezed right into my eyes. And then it sank back down again. And I have never respected an animal more. Well played, turtle, well played.
I'm just relieved that Brian won't eat things that impersonate him. That's me and John Coulshaw. So we ask, as always, we ask the audience a question, and today we ask them, if you could be another animal, what animal would you like to be and why? And our answers include babelfish, nice warm home and a good command of languages, and I'd be valuable. That's a very pragmatic response, Bill Kay.
This one's it's a bit sad. A worm, because I can have my very own wormhole. Although it's not sad, it's about a physics wormhole. Yeah. It's a wormhole travelling to different dimensions.
It's not nature, which you find sad.
A worm.
It's physics, which
I
like.
I think it was just someone who's been very sad thinking a wormhole would be a great thing. But it's because of wormhole, yes, travelling between distant parts of the universe. That's what it really is about, isn't it? I misread that. I was in biology mode rather than physics mode. I will reset.
Yeah, biology he always finds sad. Oh.
Sad. Organic.
Yeah, mating. But the heat death of the universe. Oh, da 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 da.
A head lice atop of Brian Cox's shiny hair.
A lion, as my girlfriend fancies Robin Ince. He should just take note of that. Grr.
I'd be an Icelandic pony, so Brian Cox could. No, I'm not saying that.
Looking at this what one that got? Says, your girlfriend fancies Robin Ince. If you wanted to be any animal, mouse just guide dog. A panda, so people all over the world will be desperate for me to get my leg over.
Thank you very much to our panel, Rory Wilson, Lucy Cook and Rufus Hound. Next week we are looking at something which has been implicated in 5 out of the 6 mass extinctions on planet Earth, volcanoes. The explosive set dressing, of course, of all Brian's TV shows. So I'll be asking questions about Vesuvius and Krakatoa and Eeyore Fitler Ukult. And Brian will just sit there going, been there, been there, been there twice. Been on top of that one, landed on that one, walked up that one.
Not the last one. What was the last one again?
It was Eeyore Fitler Ukult. Anyway, goodbye.
Feel now nice again?
Hello, I'm Robin Ince.
And I'm Brian Cox. It is the last episode of the series, so we thought we'd return to our favourite subject, at the end of the world.
Are you ready for the next mass extinction?
I said, are you ready for the next mass extinction? Yes!
The nihilist predominantly on the right there. So we are going to examine the main culprit for 5 out of 6 mass extinctions on the planet Earth, as well as the reason that Brian was delayed at the Charles de Gaulle Airport for 17 hours in 2010, which he considers a greater tragedy than those 5 mass extinctions because they ran out of little brandy miniatures.
Today we are discussing the science of volcanoes. How have they influenced the history of our planet from the origin of life to the great mass extinctions, and do they still pose a threat today?
We'll also be dealing with forensic volcanology, which is basically somewhere between Silent Witness and Up Pompeii. Please yourselves.
Though, to be honest, the main reason we're doing this show is that last week Robin learned how to pronounce this Icelandic volcano.
Eyjafjallajökull.
What was that again?
Eyjafjallajökull. And that is, by the way, why in the next series we're going to be dealing with Minarete Taranikas Abeyer Diffusen Changa Duni Kofus Nedel Malinga Abhöte.
Is that Norwegian for a device that measures the distance between two particles in a crystal?
Yes, it is.
I think we should just check the pronunciation of that, because we do have an actual Norwegian saying that word properly.
Minoritetsladningsbare diffusionskoeffisient målingsapparatur.
Nothing like it.
it is genuinely Norwegian for a device that measures the distance between two particles in a crystal. They've got a single word for that.
I got one of them for Christmas.
what do you call it?
It's jolly useful.
What do you call it in your house?
When I'm pissed, I call it a fringe-a-fringe-a-fringe.
And surely, Joe, you call it a minarete yazababa disengirna kerfet isn't threatened melling uprooter.
I use it to measure the distance between London and Clanfire Pukwingish in Dredsburg-a-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la
we'll go off to Aya, Yaffa, Yakov. So, to help us understand the implications of volcanoes and their pronunciation, we are joined by three volcanologists of note, and they are...
I'm Clive Oppenheimer. I'm a professor of volcanology at the University of Cambridge. And my favourite volcano is Mount Erebus in Antarctica. It's a pretty chilly place, but I do go there in the British winter. So I escape the weather here for about 6 weeks by going way, way south.
I'm Tamsin Mather. I'm a professor of earth sciences at the University of Oxford. My favourite volcano is Villarrica volcano in Chile. It's a stunningly beautiful volcano with an ice cap. It's pumping out gas all the time, so you can make great measurements there. And when you finish your day of measurements, you can slide back down the ice cap with all your equipment, which is a lot of fun, as long as you don't get out of control and end up with a bruised bottom.
Hello, I'm Joe Brand. I'm afraid the third volcanologist of note couldn't make it tonight, so I've stepped in briefly. And my favourite volcano is Popocatépetl on the Isle of Wight.
Tamsin, we always begin these shows, well, usually with a kind of definition. Now, in some ways, people might think this is odd, but I do want you to define. What is a volcano?
Well, I guess to have a volcano, you kind of need a source of heat in a planet and something to melt. So on Earth, mainly volcanoes are from melting the mantle, which is the layer below the crust in the Earth. So we get when you melt the mantle, you get magma. First of all, basaltic magma, and if that magma then finds its way up through the crust, you get a volcano or volcanism.
And then you mentioned that the structure of the Earth, you go to the crust and the... So could you, if you just describe a cross-section through the Earth, could you just give us that sort of one-minute introduction to geology, as it were, Clive, and which bits are playing roles in developing a volcano?
Yeah, so when you see a volcano erupt, obviously it's telling you that it's hotter down in the Earth's interior than it is at the surface. And that heat is coming from the radioactive decay of things like uranium and thorium and potassium inside the Earth. There's also heat left over from its initial formation and very early history, from all the bombardments that formed it and so on. And volcanism is an expression of that heat getting out at the surface, as Tamsin was saying. So you have the crust, which is this kind of thin layer at the outer part of the Earth, and beneath that is the mantle, which is kind of the largest.
And then the core.
And then the core. The core is, which is made of iron and nickel and sulfur. And the outer part of the core is really the only substantial region of the Earth's interior that is liquid. And it's currents in the outer core that generate the Earth's magnetic field. And then the inner part of the core is solid, and over time the core is solidifying and crystallizing. And that's another source of heat into the Earth's mantle from the latent heat that is released on crystallization. And that's also helping the mantle, which is a solid rock, to convect on geological timescales and drive a lot of the volcanism that we see at the surface of the planet.
So it moves really, really slowly, about the sort of speed that your fingernails grow. So it's not convection how we think of it, like in a cup of tea or a cup of coffee when you see, you put your milk in and you get the swirling sort of sensation. But it's, really, really slow movement.
That's what happened when I went in for the 5K charity run in my local park, 2.5 centimetres a year. I came last, but never mind.
Joe, are you someone who, we're talking about these kind of things, and obviously both these guys, they've been travelling around, they go up close to volcanoes. Are you someone who is one for an adventure holiday for, you know, snorkeling around thermal vents and climbing up volcanoes?
Love an adventure holiday. No, it's an adventure for me going to the fridge, to be honest with you. But, so, no, I am very interested in volcanoes and kind of science generally. But one of the things I love about science is abbreviations of scientific departments. Can I just tell you, there's an institute in the Philippines called FIVLOX. Do you know what that is?
Philvox.
Oh, I read it. So I was going to say I'm anorexic, but that's the wrong word. The other one. Anyway, I was thinking, what's it called? FIVLOX.
Philippine Institute of Volcanology and Seismology.
I think that's a bit of a ridiculous abbreviation. Why can't they just call it the Volcano Department?
Because it's in the Philippines. So it's the Philippines. Is that ridiculous they call it the Philippine Institute of Volcanoes?
They need to say PVD.
Well, it's because it begins with PH.
Philippines Volcano Department.
I agree.
It's not our fault, is it?
It sounds like a better job, doesn't it? Where do you work? Down the Volcano Department. That sounds pretty cool, doesn't it, as opposed to PIVLOX.
Yeah, but if you're at an international conference and everybody's there and everybody's just called it the Volcano Department.
Where do you work? The Volcano Department. Where do you work? Oh, the Volcano Department.
Yeah, but that's what we know. That's fine, isn't it? I don't care whether someone, then they tell me, to show me some slides of volcanoes, fine. Then they'll tell me where they're from.
Don't know these volcanoes, who's?
Well, you were saying before, weren't you, Clive, about the, you have various acronyms, don't you, for the, some of the organisations you have.
Yes, I try to think of what my last grant proposal that I'll submit to a funding council will be, which really takes the mickey in the way that the acronym spells out. They're not all polite, so I'm doing that myself.
There was a conference I was at where a team from another country had come up with the airborne remote sensing experiment.
See, they're quick, aren't they?
Yeah.
Radio 2 audience, they'd still be thinking. Not a Radio 4 audience.
Much quicker than I am.
Should we get back onto the site?
Sorry.
Thames and volcanoes, I suppose they have a reputation for being a bad thing. We think of them erupting and the damage that they cause. But they are a necessary, integral part of the Earth's the system, the climate system, aren't they? So they play a key role.
Well, a very long geological timescales. They sort of played a role in maintaining our planet as well as sort of maybe the more headline grabbing, perturbing our planet. So just to take an example, there's a sort of balance in terms of the carbon cycle, the natural carbon cycle that is, not sort of since we've been, but for the last sort of 500 million years. A balance between volcanic emissions putting carbon dioxide out into the atmosphere, and then weathering taking carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. And if the temperature goes up, the weathering rate increases, you take a bit more carbon dioxide out. The temperature goes down, the opposite happens. And you've got your volcanoes pumping out your carbon dioxide all the time. So it's like part of a thermostat, if you like, that keeps the temperature much more stable than it would be otherwise over geological timescales.
And how big a shifts, Clive, do the big volcanic eruptions cause in the climate temporarily?
If we look at the last 100,000 years or so, there are a number of volcanic eruptions that have been considerably larger than things that we've seen in modern times. And these eruptions can change the climate, not from the carbon dioxide emissions, but from the sulfur dioxide emissions, which end up oxidizing in the stratosphere and forming minute particles of sulfuric acid that can intercept some of the incoming sunlight. So there's a net cooling at the Earth's surface. And so this is something that we see with very large events like Krakatoa in 1883, the eruption of Tambora in 1815. But if we look on geological timescales, there are also huge lava outpourings that have modulated the climate on somewhat longer timescales.
So what are the in terms of, first of all, human history, what are the key very large eruptions that we've experienced?
We've been through quite a few, and in fact one of our best archives of data on past volcanism is in the ice cores in Antarctica and Greenland. And we see the fallout of this sulfur dust. Sometimes we find the ash as well. So an eruption in Indonesia, the dust will be transported in both hemispheres. It'll rain out over the polar regions, and we can find these layers of sulfur or acid layers in the ice cores. And these show that there are many events that were colossal in, say, the last 2,000 years, and we have no idea which volcanoes produced them. So we know a handful. We know Krakatoa, we know Tambora in Indonesia. We've recently identified a volcano responsible for a huge sulfur layer in the ice cores in the mid-13th century, and that's another Indonesian volcano.
And but by colossal, what can you give us a picture of what those eruptions were like?
Yeah, so in fact we use colossal as a technical term in volcanology.
A technical term.
It is. Colossal.
You see, we're trying to, you know, do what Joe's asking for, just to get rid of all the jargon and just use everyday words. So a colossal eruption will involve. We measure the size of an eruption by the amount of pumice, ash, lava that it produces, how much volume or how much mass, and. One of these eruptions, like Tambora in 1815, is producing something like 100 cubic kilometres of pumice that is showered across the land surface and the oceans. And to put that in context, if you piled all of that up within the M25, it would kind of cover the Houses of Parliament. Big Ben would poke out of the top.
Now, I like it when people do explanations like that. If you piled it up, it'd be the size of something you know.
And it wasn't a swimming pool.
Yeah, I wondered whether it was going to be the size of whales.
that's the usual unit of disaster.
Yes, it is.
True,
yeah, absolutely. Can I just ask a 5-year-old Div's question? Can you envisage a scenario when all the volcanoes go off together?
Yes.
Really? Is that...
Oh, just in business.
Is that when...
can I ask you, by the way, Joe, in future not to ask any 5-year-old Div questions, because that is very much my job.
Oh, sorry.
That eruption in 1815, what effect would that have had on the climate? So would we have seen a 1-degree, 2-degree drop in average temperatures? What would it have been?
The 1815 eruption... had a global impact that if you average the temperatures over a year, so the year 1816, which was popularly known as the year without a summer in North America, the globally averaged reduction temperature is a fraction of a degree, maybe 0.8 degrees, something like that. But it's masking much stronger regional variations in space and time. So in many parts of Europe, Eurasia, Scandinavia, the cooling in the summer was a few degrees, similarly in North America. So what this does is to affect agriculture, and thereby it affects the crop yields, and that affects the grain prices, and then that affects human society, people having to spend more on the basic staples.
Some of the more fascinating work of, I think, both of you that I've read, where you try to correlate the eruptions with things that happen.
Yes, so I think, you know, what we're trying to do here really is to contribute to understanding history and what were the impacts of these volcanically mediated environmental changes on human society. And so this takes you into kind of the general questions of history of how do you explain things with the evidence that you've got? There are always so many factors. And actually in this case of the eruption of Tambora in 1815, the grain prices are very high, and there were protests in England. People went on the streets chanting bread or blood because people were really suffering. In Switzerland, many people died from famine. There were migrations. So, you know, on one level, you can come up with a chain of causality. The eruption changed the climate affected crops, this affected people. But then you also have to look at what else was going on in history at that time, and the Napoleonic Wars had just finished. So Europe was in disarray, and this is also part of the kind of the template by which environmental forcing plays out.
Tamsin, can I say, because we're talking now about the kind of some of the more deathly sides of volcanoes, but also in terms of undersea volcanoes, which you've been talking about the majority, how much do they play a part perhaps in life as well, the idea of thermal vents, etc.? Do we have volcanoes both giving life and taking it away?
That's a good strap line. Well, it's one of the theories. So you have these wonderful kind of ecosystems that grow up around the black smokers, and you've obviously got so that's where you've got the plates spreading apart under the oceans. You have the pressure dropping on the mantle, which causes it to melt, and then you have volcanism happening at the mid-oceanic ridges. And as you say, that's where actually the majority of volcanism on our planet is, but it's kind of hidden from us underneath the oceans. And when you get seawater circulating through those types of environments, you end up with these really sort of strong temperature and chemical gradients. And that's a really, one of the sort of prime candidates for where you might have ended up with, the sort of weird and wacky chemistry of life, evolving first off on the planet. There are other candidates as well.